Problem. Even if you're visiting, you can take one for today if you want to look at it today, and then you can leave it on the pew or leave it on the back table or hand it to me afterward. But especially if you're going to be here, I think you will benefit from having a booklet and following along. Okay, and we'll go ahead and get started. If you're coming in, get a booklet. John Albert and Tosin are passing them out, and like I said, everyone can get one, and we can make more if we need to for Wednesday. This class is going to run from now until the end of February. If anybody pays attention, there's a schedule back there. We're changing the schedule a little bit. Originally, we were going to be starting a marathon class of Jeremiah now, running all the way through the spring. But since Beth and I may be getting a call at any moment to jump on a plane and go to Arizona and be out there for a few weeks or more, I'm going to hold off on starting Jeremiah until we get back, so probably in March. And this was a class that we were going to do later on in the year that we've moved up, and so we'll do this from now until the end of February, looking at the Psalms of Thanksgiving. And we'll talk about what that means as we go forward. Why don't you look at page 3 of your booklet to start out. And let's talk about our learning goals and make some sense of that. The first goal we have in this class is to read for meaning. We're going to actually wait to get into the specific Psalms for the first couple classes, because we want to understand how we read these Psalms. There's a certain technique, there's certain understandings, I think, that will help us to read and get the most out of it. As we're going to see, Psalms are a unique type of writing, and so they don't read the same as other things we read in the Bible. Also, many of these Psalms have a context, a story behind them that can help us to get the most out of the Psalm, and so our first goal is to read and understand, read for meaning. And then, as we do that, we want to identify features of these Psalms of Thanksgiving. Justin, I think it was it last Sunday, and talking about David, and we talked about some Psalms in his class on David, introduced us to the idea that there are different types of Psalms. There are Psalms that are written for different occasions, very similar to the way you would open up a songbook in front of you, and there are songs in there that are for different occasions. There are some that you would sing at a funeral, some that you would not want to sing at a funeral, some that you would sing on a celebratory occasion, others that would not be as appropriate for that. In the same way, there are different types of Psalms. We'll talk more about this on Wednesday. And so as we read and understand these Psalms, we want to be able to see what's unique about them and what makes them Psalms of Thanksgiving and what that Thanksgiving means and what it looks like. And I'll just tease this a little bit. It may be different than what you're thinking coming into this class about what a Psalm of Thanksgiving is. At least in terms of the way we typically think of that idea. All right, the next goal then, as we read it and understand it, as we see the Thanksgiving in these Psalms, the goal is to see God and to see Him more clearly. These Psalms of Thanksgiving, what the psalmist is saying, what he's expressing in each of these Psalms, it says something about who God is. It says something about God's nature, His character. It also says something about the way that God relates to His people and the way His people relate to Him. But we want to be able to see all of that. Of course, that's what we're doing. We're not just reading for academic purposes. We're reading this to understand God better and to understand our relationship with Him. And then once we do that, the kind of final goal is to improve our prayers and to pray these types of prayers, to pray with purposeful thanks, to understand the Psalms of Thanksgiving, to see God, and then to, as we pray to Him, imitate these same things and to pray to Him with that that learning, that understanding motivating us. So this is the goals for the class, all right? Turn to page 8, just real quickly. I want you to notice, turn to page 8 and 9. That's going to be, I think, next Sunday. This is the first lesson that we'll get into actually looking at a psalm. And I want you to see that what you're to do for homework, or somebody said pre-class activity, if homework scares you. But for the pre-class activity, what you're doing basically is following these same ideas, okay? That for the pre-class activity, you are to read the psalm or psalms in one case that's assigned for that week, okay? Then you're going to try to identify in that psalm after you read it, identify what makes it a psalm of thanksgiving, okay? Then there's some questions about what we learn about God from the psalm. And then also, and I really hope you'll do this, this is one of those things that's probably a little bit, as the kids say today, awkward to do. But I'm asking you to write a prayer in your booklet. Now, maybe you're not comfortable with that. You want to use a journal or something. That's fine. But I'm encouraging us to write a prayer each week that imitates or that uses what you're learning or what you're appreciating from that psalm and incorporate it into a prayer that you would pray to God. And so each week as you go through the pre-class activity, please don't see that as busy work. We're actually trying to accomplish each of these things that we're setting out to do in the course overall. And what that's going to require each week is for us to read ahead of time and to make that a habit, okay? It's also going to encourage us to participate as we come to class. And by the way, participating doesn't always mean talking, right? That's something I need to take to heart more. But participating involves, well, I'll ask you, what does participating involve? Listening. Thank you, Sarah. Listening, yeah. Actively listening. And listening to who? Yeah, everybody. Okay, you're supposed to say me, Sarah. Listen to the teacher. You know. Listen to me. No, I hope you listen to me, but also as we share our thoughts together to listen openly and actively to what other people have to say, okay? And then to listen and to be open in your participation in the class. And also it will require us to pray and to push ourselves to do that. So that's the goals of this class and what we're trying to accomplish overall over the next 6 or 7 weeks, and then what each class will look like, at least in your preparation, okay? All right, let's look at the learning plan very briefly on page 2. This is just the schedule, so refer to this. It has the dates. That doesn't help you if I point up there. It has the dates, so if you miss a class, or you're trying to prepare ahead of time, then you know what we're on according to that date, and then this is the psalm, and it tells you where in the booklet that is. I am attempting to, in theory, we're going to have people on call to teach each of these classes so that at any point, and I'm just sure that on one of these Sundays, it's going to be like 8:45, right? And I'm going to be up for sermon in class, and then we're going to get a call, and then somebody here is going to have 45 minutes to put everything together. I just know that's going to happen. So, but there, we will have other people teaching at some point, most likely during this quarter when I am away. Okay, so that's the plan to refer to on page 2. Any questions about how this class is going to go? Okay. Let's go to page 4 and talk about genres of literature. What's a genre? That's how they say that. It's not genre, by the way. I mean, that took me like 25 years to figure that out. What's a genre? What's a genre of literature or genre of movie or something? A style? Okay. A classification? Okay. And what are some different types of genres in literature? You walk into Barnes & Noble. They're going to have different sections based on genre. What are some genres of literature? Fiction, science fiction, horror, romance, right? Nonfiction. It's always confusing because nonfiction means it is real, and fiction means it's not real. And so you're like, it should be the other way around, you know? So now you're going to be confused the rest of your life, right? Or fiction can be based on real. Yeah, or it could be historical fiction, right? Which is, so there's all kind of different things, right? And if you're in different sections of Barnes & Noble, and you pick up a book here, and then you go across the store and pick up another book. Say you pick up a fiction book, and then you go pick up a cookbook, right on the other side. Are you going to read those two books the same? I don't think so, okay? I don't think you're going to read your cookbook the same way you read your novel, okay, your fiction novel, right? So there are different genres of literature, and that determines the way that literature is read. You know that the Bible is a similar thing. The Bible is, in some ways, is a library that is made up of different genres of literature. What genres do we find in the Bible? There are letters. There's personal correspondences that are in our Bibles. There's history. What did you say?
Narrative.
Yeah, and narrative and history go together, basically. Okay, it's a narrative. It's a story. We'll talk some about that today. And we have books of history that follow a narrative format. What else?
Poetry,
songs and poetry. Okay, in a book like Psalm, the Song of Songs. There's prophecy, oracles. Okay. Right. There are other ones you could think of. There's like lists and genealogies, so like legal documents that list out people's names and numbers and all that kind of stuff. Okay. There's lots of different kinds of literature in the Bible, and again, you would read it differently. Okay, you read the book of Ephesians differently than you read the book of Song of Solomon. Okay, and different than you would read the book of Genesis. There's different genres in that. It means something. So let's talk about that. On page 4, you have what I think is a really cool example. You have two texts side by side. On page 4, on the and I don't have a booklet. Am I right on this? Okay, you guys are like looking. What is that? Come on. Okay. On page 4, you have, on the left side, you have a narrative account of the Red Sea event that comes from Exodus 14. That's just the story as it's told in the text. And then on the right side, you have what comes in Exodus 15, which is the Song of Moses. And it's describing the same event, the Red Sea event, but it's a song, it's poetry, that they're singing after this has happened, right? So same event described in two different forms, in a narrative form and in a poetic form. I just realized I do need a booklet. So let's read this. Are there more back here? Yeah, there's more back here. All right, as we read, and you can use your pen or pencil, I'm encouraging you to do that. As we read, look for similarities and differences between these two accounts, between the narrative on the left and the poetry on the right. All right, starting with the left, Exodus 14, 21 to 31. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and made the sea dry land. And the waters were divided. And the people of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. The Egyptians pursued and went in after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea, that the water may come back upon the Egyptians, upon the chariots and their horsemen." So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal course when the morning appeared. And as the Egyptians fled into it, the Lord threw the Egyptians into the midst of the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and their horsemen. Of all the host of Israel that had followed them into the sea, not one of them remained. But the people of Israel walked on dry ground through the sea, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians. And Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Israel saw the great power that the Lord used against the Egyptians, so the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and his servant Moses. Okay, now let's read the other account, Exodus 15, 4 to 12, the Song of Moses, at least part of it. Pharaoh's chariots and his hosts he cast into the sea, and his chosen officers were sunk in the Red Sea. The floods covered them, they went down into the depths like a stone. Your right hand, O Lord, glorious in power, your right hand, O Lord, shatters the enemy. In the greatness of your majesty, you overthrow your adversaries. You send out your fury. It consumes them like stubble. At the blast of your nostrils, the waters piled up. The floods stood up in a heap. The deeps congealed in the heart of the sea. The enemy said, "I will pursue, I will overtake, I will divide the spoil. My desire shall have its fill of them. I will draw my sword, my hand shall destroy them." You blew with your wind, and the sea covered them. They sank like lead in the mighty waters. Who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glorious deeds, doing wonders? You stretched out your right hand, the earth swallowed them. Okay, take a minute on your own, to yourself, and mark down some observations in your booklet, some similarities and differences between these two accounts here on page 4. I'll give you about 60 seconds. Okay, now for the next minute or two, turn to a neighbor and share your findings with someone close to you and discuss these differences between the narrative and the poetry. Thirty more seconds. Okay, let's collect these together. And you may have already been thinking in these terms, but of course you can think about a classic Venn diagram here. On one side we have the narrative in Exodus 14, the story form of this account, and then we have the song of Moses in 15, which is poetic on the other side. And there are going to be some overlaps, and then there will be differences. So let's begin. Let's start. We'll go left to right here. Let's start with the middle one. How about that? What is similar between these two? Okay, the facts of the event.
It's also similar. The intention is very clear, is that the power of God is very evident in both of them.
The power of God, Daniel says, is very evident in both of these. Other similarities? We all were focused on the differences, I guess, right? So let's do that. Maybe we can come back to the similarities. Story, the Exodus 14 on the left side. What was there? Just the facts, Mike says. What else would you say?
Chronological.
Okay.
Details. Lots of details.
Lots of details. Would you say more details than in the poetic account? Okay. In some ways, yeah. Getting some nods of heads, okay. Maybe, go ahead, Wendy.
Not a lot of emotion that is addressed.
Okay, not a lot of emotion that is addressed. It was what Wendy says, okay. And I think I heard somebody over here in discussion mentioning a similar point, okay. Other things you want to say about the narrative account?
There's no judgment on whether it's good or bad, particularly. It's just, this is what happened at that point.
Okay, Lee says there's no judgment in particular on what's good and bad, but it's just, this is what happened, laying that out.
There's the thoughts of the people where we were, you're seeing the facts.
Okay, no thoughts of the people, Sarah says. You're just getting the facts. Okay, then what about the poetry on the other side of the diagram here, over here, Exodus 15? What makes that distinct relative to the other?
It's spoken like this is how what happened made me feel more so a lot more emotion.
Okay, more so emotion, and Anita seconded that opinion there. Other distinctive traits of the poetry.
There's addressing God, like, you know, they're calling God as mighty and things that you can infer that from the narrative, but no one is saying that outright.
Okay, the poetry, John says, is an address from the people that are speaking it to God. It's a expression to him. We have several people going here, so we'll just come to the front. Jared?
We see a picture of God here. Like, I picture when I read this, there's no way I can read this without seeing God like a big giant. Like, when he wants to move waters, he blows. When he wants to do something, he swipes his hand. Like, I see God as just this massive giant that I don't picture that in the other one.
Okay, you can see God in a certain way. Wendy, we can get the other two up here. Wendy, were you going to?
The way that it's written in the phrases, you see a lot of space, and that's kind of where more of your imagination and the picturing of it can fill in.
Okay, and Janet, you were going to?
So it was a brief history.
Okay.
Poetry was a brief history that's over here.
Okay, it's a brief history. In some ways, you could say it doesn't take as many lines in some ways to get the same idea across. Robert?
Yeah, on the right-hand side, the focus is on God. There's nothing, there's no mistaking. It's all about God, and it's about what he did and how people should react to him. On the left, it was really about here's how the people felt, here's how Moses felt, here's how the Egyptians felt, and then here's the ultimate outcome. So you get the same perspectives, but on the right-hand side, the focus is one.
Okay, we'll take one more. Lee, you're going to...
I was going to say, the point of view shifts on the poetic side, where it talks about, this is how we felt, this is what God was doing, and then it says, oh, but the enemy said this and this. So you have a change in perspective and a point of view from that you don't necessarily see on... It's a third-party view on both in both the narrative and the poetic side, except... the narrative side, it's just one. It's, you know, an outsider telling you this is what happened. But then on the poetic side, you're actually taking a different point of view.
Okay, so let's just roll this conversation into these next two questions. And now we're going generally here. As again, we're back to this idea of genres in the Bible, and Exodus 14 and 15 gives us a nice kind of specific case study. Jason, there's booklets right there on the back if you want to grab one and follow along. We also have... just to come give you a hard time. So generally speaking then, from our example, what would you extrapolate from this? How is reading poetry different from reading narrative? Okay, Anita says poetry evokes emotion more so than narrative. What else would you say about reading poetry, how that's different?
More colorful language.
More colorful language? Not in necessarily the way we sometimes say colorful language, but it is more colorful language.
It's just harder to follow.
It's hard. Oh, Robert says it's more. Anybody feel this? Anybody on Team Robert here? You didn't never liked poetry in high school because it was just hard to understand. George.
Yes. I was going to say it doesn't have to abide by any particular rules, right? So like the narrative is, like we were talking about, it's chronological. It's the details. It's the facts. But poetry, it doesn't have to be chronological. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't have any rules it has to follow. So.
Okay. Sarah's saying that some of the rules you're expecting in narrative, she mentions chronology among others, poetry doesn't have to follow those rules. It can be out of order time-wise, okay? And maybe that's part of what Robert means when he says it's hard to follow, okay? So it is colorful. It's imaginative. It is evoking of emotion, as Anita said, okay? But it also can be hard to follow. And a little more slippery, maybe, to get a hold of, right? And maybe this is a similar question, or at least related, but how or what does poetry offer that narrative doesn't? And again, this is more general. You could draw a specific example from our activity here, but just in general, what does poetry offer that narrative doesn't offer?
Feeling.
Feeling, Harrison says. That would connect back to what Anita said about emotion. Perspective. You want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Perspective of someone in the story that you just read. Like, this is obviously from the people who are Moses being grateful to God and wanting to praise him. And, you know, that's the perspective of the poem here.
Yeah.
John, I would add on to that what is most important to the author comes out Okay. What's most important to this story to me is how the people walked on dry ground. That just, like, but that's not in the psalm at all. So.
And what is in this? What is in the psalm?
That the Pharaoh's army was destroyed. I mean, that's what comes out first. Even before the waters are pulled back, he talks about the armies being destroyed. And it's done by the might of God.
And I would connect what John's saying back to what Shannon's saying, that you get a perspective in the poetry of the people involved in the events. And somebody mentioned this earlier. Remember in our example, even Pharaoh, there was words put in the mouth of the Egyptians, right? Now, I don't want to, this is maybe a little bit too prickly here, but did the Egyptians necessarily say these words here that are put out here, okay?
It provides the motives, I guess, of their actions.
The point of it is to show this is what they were thinking, this is what they were feeling, right? This is what was going through their minds, okay? I'm going to attack, I'm going to crush, I'm going to conquer, right? So it gives you the perspective, as Shannon says, of the things of the people in the story. What they're feeling has already been said, and that's, I think, to John's point, that then that what comes out of that is, here's what's most important, here's what's being emphasized. Robert? And
yeah, so just it's actually stating, this is the judgment, this is the motive of people, or the activities, and, you know, we always like, well, don't judge me, I didn't say that. Well, that's exactly what this poetry is doing, and saying, this is exactly the why behind the facts of what happened.
Sarah?
And I was going to say, you know, the purpose in writing poetry or in songwriting, part of it is storytelling, and that was a big part of what, you know, the people did back then, when they created stories that they could pass on. And the short and condensed version of the poetry gives you the highlights and the emotion that was important to pass on.
And that may connect back to what Janet said about the kind of condensing of the story. In the poetic form. Okay, so poetry is a different animal than narrative. That's kind of one of the key points we want to take away from this. And hopefully we're seeing that and we're understanding that we're going to have to read a little bit differently, okay? There's the use of imagination, as we talk about imagery or figurative language, more on that in a second, okay? It's a little bit, it takes a little more focus, I guess, maybe, if things are going to perhaps jump around and things don't follow a chronological order, okay? And there's going to be a pay attention to perspectives and the feeling that is being expressed and evoked in the poems or in the songs, okay? So let's talk a little bit more. This will be on page 5 here. On features of poetry and what we're looking for in particular. Okay, so speaking of high school English class, take yourself back, all right? What are, and I'm not asking you the difference, although someone's probably ready. They're like, I know the difference, so I'm going to tell everybody so they know I know, okay? But what are we talking about when we talk about metaphor and simile? These are going to be, and we're not covering all of them, but some features that we'll be seeing a lot in the poetry that we're looking at. What is metaphor and simile? Okay, a comparison that makes it more relatable. Who else, what would you say about metaphor and simile? What are we talking about? Daniel said it. What more to add? Okay. And what do we mean by comparison? And maybe you have some of the examples are easier than definitions, so feel free to give me an example.
Something is like something else, or something is seen as something else.
Okay.
Something is seen as something else, and okay, we'll say it. What's the difference between metaphor and simile? Simile uses, yeah, at like or as, okay. Those things are just ingrained in you. You forgot everything else from high school, and then there's like that 5 things that you remember. And metaphor doesn't use that. A metaphor will just say, this is this other thing. Okay, but we're not concerned with the differences here, especially when you're translating from Hebrew. That kind of stuff is not going to be as particular. The point is, we're going to see comparisons, that something is compared to something else. And what's the point of doing that? Daniel said that it makes it more relatable. But what happens when you relate something, you know, to something else? If I got to be careful here what I say, but you know, you relate somebody to a certain kind of animal, right? What's the point of doing that? Okay, it gives you an image in your mind.
Better understanding.
A better understanding. There's shared characteristics there. Okay, so we understand the purpose of it, but what is it? What do you have to do if you're reading stuff that has metaphor and simile? What does that take on the part of the reader? Okay, you have to understand both things. Okay, what else does it require? We kind of have said this already. You have to use. I did that before. Imagine someone's. It's from. Never mind. I'm not even going to say what TV show it's from because it's so embarrassing. If you know, then you know that it's embarrassing what that's from. You have to use your imagination. Okay, you have to use your imagination when we're talking about, you know, visualizing these images, okay, and comparing a person to an animal or comparing an object to some other fantastic thing or something. Okay, so metaphor and simile is a part of poetry, and there are specific kinds of metaphor and simile. Okay, one of the ones we see a lot in biblical poetry is personification. What is personification? Okay. You mean, are you studying this in optometry school? I don't. This is where all this is coming from. Here. Okay, you're giving an inanimate object human characteristics. Okay, in the Bible, I think we can also put into this category when God is described. So, if you want to really get technical, that's called an anthropomorphism. Okay, bet you didn't know that. but when you say that God blew with the breath of his nostrils. Okay, we understand that's metaphor. Okay, that's comparing God to what he's doing to something we can visualize, but technically it's an anthropomorphism because we're talking about God as if he is a man and has nostrils and can blow that. Okay, but personification is similar in that it talks about something as if it is a human. Okay, when Yun Dawn with her rose red fingers shone once more. I'll give you $5 if you can tell me after class what that's from, but that's metaphor and simile. Okay. What is hyperbole? It's an exaggeration. For what purpose? Effect, okay. And it is a little bit different than an exaggeration. I mean, I think of exaggeration, I think about like what we did as teenagers and like trying to dupe our parents, you know. But in poetry, hyperbole.
What are we talking about? Embellishment.
Okay. You want to elaborate on that a little bit? You want to embellish that? All right. It is an embellishment. It's an extreme, and the extreme is for the purpose of effect, as George said, or for the purpose of making a point. Okay, there's something to be gained from that. But again, what does it take as you're reading? What does it require as a reader when you're reading something that has hyperbole in it? Okay, you have to understand the difference. You have to know it's not literal. Understand the difference between hyperbole and something that is literal. But again, that's part of knowing you're reading poetry. Okay, parallelism is something I think we've talked about before. And I want to spend a little bit more time on this. Actually, you can turn if you want. I'm going to put it up on the screen. One of the earliest poems in the Bible is found in Genesis chapter 4. It's an interesting discussion, by the way. We can have it later if you're really interested. You may have to get a cup of coffee, but it's an interesting discussion about what the first example of poetry is in Scripture. But one that's early, that's not necessarily the first, is in Genesis chapter 4. And it's nice because it's succinct. Oh, man, easy for you to say. It is succinct, but it also kind of pops up out of nowhere, and so it's easy to just analyze the lines and not worry about what else is going on in the context. But this is the words of Lamech, who is the seventh in the line of Cain in Genesis chapter 4. And here's what he says. Ada and Zillah, hear my voice. You wives of Lamech, listen to what I say. I have killed a young man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. If Cain's revenge is sevenfold, then Lamech's is 77-fold. Okay. Maybe you're already kind of getting a sense of what we mean by parallelism, okay? But what we mean by parallelism is a set of lines, at least two, of course, but it can be three or four or a bunch of lines, but a set of lines, so for our purposes now, let's think just in terms of two, that match each other, and that matching helps us to understand more of what's being said, okay? So let's kind of go through this. Lamech begins by referring to Ada and Zillah, or Ada and Zillah. I don't know. Okay. What's the parallel to this in the next line? Okay, they're the wives of Lamech, right? So if you didn't know that, you get to the second line, and you're like, oh, that's who that is. It's the wives of Lamech, okay? He says, hear my voice, and the parallel to that is, listen to what I say. Okay, so you see how simple this can be here. So if we just stopped here, you might be tempted to say, oh, okay, a parallelism is just a restating of the line that came before. And you would be wrong, okay? Don't think that. Okay? It's not simply a restating, okay? Oftentimes, and we're not talking about 100% of the cases, but usually the restating has a purpose of some sort, okay? So for instance, he says, I have killed a man for wounding me. What's the parallel to I have killed a man? Yeah, the parallel is right below it. Again, this is kind of an easier, in terms of where they match up, it's a little bit more straightforward. But what happens when you go to the next line? When you read, I've killed a man, it's like, okay. What happens when you get to the next line and he says, he restates it, but he says a young man? It's more specific. More details. But what about for your understanding and your kind of what this poem does to you? You read, okay, I killed a man, I killed a young man. Okay, yeah, Robert says sympathy. Isn't that a little bit more serious? I killed a young man, right? And now maybe you say, well, it's because it was a young man. But still, I think the point is it takes it to the next level. Okay, I killed somebody. I killed a boy, a kid, all right, teenager. All right, he says, for wounding me, and then the parallel to that is, for striking me. And there's some debate here. It could be that that also is an intensification, right? I killed a man for wounding me. You can imagine, man, he gouged out part of my arm, so I killed him, right? Well, but what if it's just I killed a young man because he slapped me, right? You see how, okay, now we're taking it to the next level. The revenge here is like even more animalistic here, right? And then he says if Cain's revenge is sevenfold, okay? But, okay, Cain's revenge parallels to Lamech's revenge, okay? And again, it's not just saying, okay, yeah, Cain had revenge and Lamech is going to have revenge. No, what's the point? The point is we're taking it to an exponential level, literally, sevenfold to 77-fold, okay? So this is what parallelism does. We'll have a chance to talk about this more as we go. But parallelism is a matching. It's a set of lines that match, okay? And that matching, and again, note, look at this. The matching is in terms of the meaning and sometimes even the syntax. It means the order of the words or the word choice that's being used, okay? And that matching is for a purpose, to enhance the meaning in some way. Maybe think about it in this way. When you read a poem in English, okay, what are you expecting to find in terms of like the structure that ties the lines together and connects line to line? What are you looking for when you read English poetry? A rhyme structure, and with rhyme usually a meter or a rhythm, okay? Put that out of your head for Hebrew poetry, partly because that's not the way they did it, and partly because it's translated anyway. So whatever rhyme there might be, we're going to miss it, okay? And again, but that's not the way they did poetry. So instead of rhyme and rhythm, think in these terms, that there's going to be a parallelism from line to line. There's going to be matching sets, and that's what ties these things together and gives us the meaning of the poem, okay? Parallelism makes some sense here? Okay, so let's practice these. We do have a few minutes, so I'll give you we'll read it together. As we're reading, you can be looking for it. So on page 5 here, circle the metaphors, put a box around any hyperboles, and underline whatever parallelism you see, and this is taken from Psalm 30. And we'll talk more about the psalm later, so for now, just focus on these features of poetry. So we'll read it together, be marking these things, and then I'll give you maybe 60 or 90 seconds to do it on your own before we share out. Sing praise to the Lord, you his godly ones. Give thanks to his holy name. For his anger is but for a moment, his favor is for a lifetime. Weeping may last for the night, but a shout of joy in the morning. O Lord, by your favor you have made my mountain to stand strong. You hid your face, and I was dismayed. To you, O Lord, I called, and to the Lord I made supplication. Okay, take 60 seconds and identify these features here. Put circles around any metaphors you see, boxes around any hyperboles you see, and underline whatever parallelism there is in this text. 60 seconds. Okay, we are perilously short of time, so let's do this together. Metaphor, or simile, but where do you see metaphor in this excerpt here? Shout it out.
Perilously short of time. Perilously short of time. Perilously.
You've made my mountain to sing.
Okay, we got a couple here. Sarah points to the weeping and the anger. Meredith points to, you have made my mountain to stand strong. Okay? Hid your face. That's what we call a anthropomorphism. There you go. Lee gets a gold star. Right? I'm still waiting for someone to tell me after class when young Dawn with her rose-red fingers shone once more. But we have my mountain. We have you hid your face. And even the weeping and shouting, perhaps a metaphor. So, we see imagery here, okay? And the imagery is invoking a meaning and a purpose behind that, okay? What about hyperbole? And what, and you want to explain?
Well, I mean, I don't have a mountain, right? So that would be exaggeration.
Sure, okay, I can see that. It is an extreme statement, okay? I would put it more in the category of metaphor because it's comparing. It's comparing my life, what I possess, if you're talking about a king, my power, my authority, it's comparing that to a mountain, right? But if it's a mountain, it is extreme. So it has hyperbolic tinge to it too. Robert?
I had the four times, for a moment, for a lifetime, last for the night, joy in the morning.
Okay.
Moment, lifetime, night. Anybody have those two as well? Those four as well? Okay. I think so, okay? Weeping may last for a night. Does the author have in mind that he literally only wept for, 8 hours over the course of an evening? Is that what he's saying? What is he saying when he says weeping may last for the night? It's a brief period. That's what it is. It could have been 3 years. But when he looks back on it, it's a brief period, okay? And so weeping may last for the night, shout of joy in the morning. And I think it's even the same thing with his anger is but for a moment, his favor for a lifetime. Even that is hyperbolic, okay? Now, it's almost like a hyperbole that doesn't go far enough. It's almost like, well, God's favor is actually eternal, right? But the idea of a lifetime is not to specify a specific amount of time. It's to say it's a long time, okay? A never-ending time, okay? And then, bell rang for the most important thing. The parallelism, okay? Let me just point out one thing, because hopefully this is, you could probably underline everything here. But let me show you that parallelism, like in these cases, doesn't always say something similar. It oftentimes makes a contrast. So notice, his anger is but for a moment, his favor is for a lifetime. Those are parallel lines. But the point of the parallelism is not to say the same thing, it's to actually say two things that are different, okay, and contrast this with that. Same thing with weeping may last for the night, but joy comes for the morning, okay? But at the beginning and end of this, you see some of the more standard versions of parallelism. Sing praise to the Lord, you his godly ones, and give thanks to his holy name. Okay, and the last one, to you, O Lord, I called, and to the Lord I made supplication. That's the more straightforward examples of parallelism, but there are some more creative uses of contrasting parallelism in this excerpt as well. Okay, thank you. That's an introduction to poetry. And then on Wednesday, we'll talk about an introduction to the Psalms. And so look forward to that. Again, if you're taking off, you can leave your book here, but if you're going to be here, then take a book and keep it and use it. Thank you, guys.